Welcome to On Background, my podcast, where I take people into the lives and careers of people who make the news. On Background's guest today, Eric Greenberg of NBC, is a producer for MSNBC's The 11th Hour with Brian Williams. I've known him for a number of years. Eric, welcome. Great to have you on.
Good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me. This is an exclusive, by the way. I'm not doing any other national media this week.
That's a great way in. Would you tell people what your life is like when you're trying to get an exclusive and why that matters, what it is and why it matters?
Well, I mean, of course, especially with Brian's show being on at 11 p.m., it's a, sort of a great slot because you can wrap up the day, but there's how many hours of programming before that, and so you don't want to have someone that's been making the rounds all day long and repeating the same interview. So it's it can be tricky, but luckily Brian has a lot of loyal guests, and we work with a lot of great journalists who you know, nowadays break stories at who knows what time of night and can come right on with us, and it's worked out great.
Now, Eric, the reason I do On Background is there are a lot of people at Columbia School of Journalism, a lot of people at Medill, at Syracuse, at the Cronkite School at Arizona. They want to know how to get to do what you're doing, producing a very important news-breaking, headlining show. So would you start us back to where you're from and where you went to school and then walk us forward, but also tell us why you have the Fonz for President on your Twitter feed at Eric J. Greenberg.
I guess I'll start with the Fonz. I guess, first of all, wouldn't the world be better if the Fonz is the president, Henry Winkler? I mean, but who I actually got to meet at MSNBC, just happened to see him in the hallway, which was like the thrill of a lifetime.
But, you know, I went to his house about a month ago and did a show with him. Nicest man in America, without question.
It's one of those guys you meet him and you're not disappointed. Like you're the most important person he's talking to, and he probably has that conversation 50 times a day. But no, that was just a little fun during the election that I just left up there. I'm from Massachusetts. I went to Syracuse. I was an English major, though.
And, oh, you didn't go to, I thought you were a J school guy. Oh, I am.
No, but I did internships throughout college, which I would highly recommend anybody do, just because things are so competitive now. The more you can have on your resume coming out of college, the more you can differentiate yourself, the better.
Where did you do your internships?
So I did a local station in Boston, WLVI, which was a WB station. I did in Syracuse, it was a local Fox affiliate and a UPN affiliate sort of under the same roof, which was unusual, but that was great. And actually Amy Kellogg, who was one of the anchors there, is now on Fox News. And I did a national radio network, a small national radio network in Massachusetts. It was called Talk America. That doesn't even exist anymore. But that was great. And actually one of the first things I did there is I booked a very unknown Brian Williams for a radio interview when MSNBC was launching.
You see, and I want to pause here for young journalists especially. You go anywhere you can, and you do everything you can for anyone who asks. That's basically media, is it not?
It is, and I think, you know, you learn as many jobs as you can, if nothing else to give you options and rule out what you don't want to do. And then even if you end up doing something different, I think the more things you know, the better it helps you understand what your colleagues are doing and helps you work with them better, which I think is sort of an underrated thing.
So I want to pause here on your internships, because again, I focus on the young people, especially on Background. How did you get the internship? Do you even remember? I mean, you're a young guy, so you can remember back 5 years. How did you get the internships?
I mean, young's a relative thing. I'm old enough that I used to actually have to write letters and put stamps on them. so that's what you did. I mean, even for my first job, I just sort of flooded letters. I mean, with the internships, there were only so many options, right? Because I either did it when I was home in the summer in Boston or in Syracuse, where there are, you know, three or four affiliates. But you send letters, and now you send emails. But the key is the follow-up, right? Because they're getting, you know, hundreds or if you're looking for national internships, maybe thousands of letters and emails, and half of them probably end up in the, you know, the spam folder, the deleted folder, not because anyone's being malicious, just because of the volume and everyone's so busy. So you have to just really be persistent, which back then was not something I was used to doing. You know, I didn't want to be a pain and want to bother people, but you have to sort of learn to do that in order to stand out.
You have to learn as well, and I tell every young would-be a media person. I am not offended by people who repeatedly send me emails because it's the avalanche effect. You've got to get your hand out of the avalanche somehow. And so if you're getting incoming at 1,000 a day like we do at the show or you do it at the 11th hour, to get anyone's attention, there's a delicate line between being a pain in the rear end and being persistent and professional. And so you have to learn how to walk that. And I'm sure you're now on the receiving end of that. What distinguishes that, Eric Greenberg?
I mean, I think it's also how you do it, right? I mean, if you do it in sort of a pompous way, you know, no one wants to hear from you. But if you do it, if you're humble and you, you know, you pick your moments, you know when to call, when not to call. You know, obviously, I don't want to get any calls from someone now looking for help. You know, 10 minutes before we're on the air, so you got to sort of know your audience and pick your spots and take time and learn about. You know, you're sending out a lot of emails, but you don't want to, you know, send one custom email and, you know, that doesn't show that you sort of want to be at that particular place for a reason, right? You want to know that people want to be on the Hugh Hewitt Show because, you know, you have this huge following and how unique you are. But
you want to know what markets a talent is on in. You want to know something about the show. You just said it. You've got to actually know what you're asking to do.
Yeah, and you should mean it, too, because you know, get excited about what you're doing. I mean, you don't have to know it's what you want to do for a lifetime, but I mean, how much more are you going to get out of it if you're looking to sort of gear your search to something that you're passionate about? And it shows, right? I mean, you can tell when someone wants to be there and when they don't.
So out of Boston to Syracuse, an English major, you do a bunch of interns, and sometimes you don't, internships, you don't get paid. Sometimes you do. It depends on the internship.
Back then, you had to pay for credits. to do it. Now it's all different. Now interns get paid.
Of the law, that's changed a lot. Tell us what you did right out of Syracuse.
So I got a job. You know, I sent an email. I really, when I started out, it wasn't like I wanted to be the next Walter Cronkite. It wasn't necessarily a journalism thing to start. I loved TV, and I loved actually talk radio. I used to go to bed every night listening to talk radio. And I just sent, like, a wide selection of resumes at the place that I was all interested in, but everywhere from, you know, news to Sesame Street. And, you know, really? I ended up getting an interview at Court TV, which I'm dating myself again because it doesn't even exist anymore. And I got a job there. I started about a month after I graduated. And
what were you doing for Court TV? That was not a bad cable channel, by the way. That was actually kind of interesting.
It was great, and I was sad to see it go away. It was, you know, it was post-OJ, so it was sort of already on people's radar a bit, but it was before it was, you know, in millions and millions of homes, which made it sort of a sweet spot for being able to do a lot. You know, I don't think you realize it at the time, but, you know, you don't just get out of college and get to write for a TV network. You don't,
right?
You know, and there you could. You know, I got to write, you know, what they call packages, you know, the little two-minute story, background stories on whatever we're covering. I got to be in the live control room. I ran the teleprompter. I did, you know, we'd get these trials. Some of them would be live. Some of them would be pre-taped. It all depended on what the judges and the courtrooms would allow. And you'd sort of sift through the trials and pick out the best bits, grab sound bites, all that kind of. It was really a cross-section of all kinds of aspects of production, which is, I think, another thing you need to look at, where it's great to work for a huge name. And I love that I work for, you know, MSNBC now and Brian Williams. But starting out, there's a lot to be said for sort of working somewhere where you're going to really get to do a lot right out of the gate.
All right. So at Court TV, how long do you stay there?
Off and on for about 3 or 4 years. I left, of all places, to be a production assistant at The Sopranos for a little bit.
And then really?
Yeah. Which was totally different, but is a fun piece of trivia on my resume.
You know, that's actually kind of risky because you left the lane. The lane is television, right? And doing the news, even Court TV news is news. But then you go into drama. That's getting out of your lane. Were you a little scared to do that?
I didn't have a lane back then. You know, I had this thing in my head that I wanted to give that a try and see what it was like to work on a show like that. And, you know, I was, 23 or whatever I was, 24. And, you know, I did it for just portions of 2 seasons, and it was.
Who's
known,
your favorite guy on the set of Sopranos?
Oh, Michael Imperioli was great. I worked in the writer's office, so as basically the assistant to the writer's assistant. So, but he also wrote some episodes, and he was always was super great when he came in, super friendly. But they're all really nice.
Okay, so from The Sopranos, you've got to come back to news. Where did you come?
Yeah, so I went back to Court TV for a bit, and then I bounced over to CNBC and worked with, I don't know if you remember back in the day, Larry Kudlow and Jim Cramer had a show together.
Yeah, that may have been when we first crossed paths. That is a distant memory because they had a great show together before they went their separate ways and both experienced extraordinary success. What
yeah,
did you do for...
But they were great together, and then that was a lot of fun. And then I started off there, like a lot of jobs, you tend to start in TV. It's not, there's no hard and fast rule, but when you start off in the sort of breaking in news, you often start doing things like working on graphics and coordinating... You know, I'd coordinate the graphics, I'd coordinate the stock charts, and they'd put it up there. Someone's in the control room pressing a button to make sure that goes up there. And then it sort of, you start doing more and more. And the two of them, like you said, went their separate ways. Jim did the Mad Money, which is, you know, took on a life
huge
of its own. And I worked with Larry for many years. And, you know, the sort of the responsibilities just grow over time.
Now, talk a little bit about the pace that goes into this, because one of the things about TV I don't think people understand is that folks who are in television, like folks who are in radio, work all the time. I mean, I really do believe Dwayne, I give him a hard time on the air about not being a producer, but I think Dwayne probably works a 70-hour week. I'm sure you do as well. It is not for people who want to clock in and clock out, Eric Greenberg, is it?
Well, especially now with everyone having iPhones and there's nowhere to hide, right? You know? So even when you're not at the office, you always have your phone on, and you don't want to miss, you know, for example, now a great guest you've been pursuing gets back to you. You don't want to miss out because you were snoozing too long. But, yeah, and especially now, too, with the way the news cycle is, right? I mean, it's, you used to be able to plan in advance so much for what you were going to cover. Now it just changes so quickly. So, yeah, you're never fully detached unless you're on vacation, and then you're still kind of checking in because you'll have 10 million emails when you get back.
Yeah, there's actually no way to go away. So Eric, what happens next? After you get over and you're at CNBC, when do you jump into hard news?
I actually had a little diversion. This is sort of the most unlikely way I think anyone's ever gotten a job. I was riding in a cab to CNBC because I missed my shuttle out there, and the cab driver starts saying making all these incredibly racist comments and trying to get me to agree with them. It was this bizarre situation, and it turned out I was on a hidden camera show called What Would You Do, hosted by John Quiñones, that's on ABC, and out of that, I somehow ended up getting a job on that show.
What a weird deal.
Yeah, I accidentally walked into the situation, and a couple years later, I stayed in touch with the producer there and ended up getting a job there at ABC.
What did you do on the camera? How did you handle the racist cabbie?
Well, I guess I wasn't racist, or they wouldn't have hired me.
Yeah, there you go. That is one of the hardest things in news. If you're on a panel or in a podium or an auditorium, when someone goes off, not on racism, that's pretty easy to spot and get disgusted.
Right.
But when people cross lines and you don't really know what to do because you're not on, so you must have had good news instincts there.
Yeah, it was bizarre. I mean, you kind of at some point figured something's up here, but it was, you're also stranded in a cab in the middle of New Jersey, so you had to be a little careful, especially when the guy seemed a little bit off. But no, I think I handled it fine. Like I said, ended up there, so that was a completely different, talk about getting out of your lane. I did it there again, and now sort of back on my lane now. As you know, I worked with Steve Kornacki for 3 years, who is awesome and is furious that you haven't had.
What's it like to work with a computer? I always. He's not real. He's a Borg. He and Michael Barone, if they ever come together in the same room, we will find that they came off of the same assembly line, separated by 30 years. You know that.
But
they're,
it's
just
so funny. He's. You see what he does on air in terms of, you know, name any county in the country,
yep,
and he'll give you the 200-year history. But he can do it with 80s sitcom themes. He can do it with, you name, his best trick is you name a stadium anywhere in the country, he'll give you off the top of his head, the seating capacity. He'll say, Providence Civic Center, he'll say hockey or basketball. And then
what's sad about that, though, is he's from Boston. And like you, he's a Patriots fan, and that makes him part of the New England Mafia.
By the way, after the Cavs game, Celtics game the other day, you got to go easy on us.
I spent the morning today that we're talking, talking about Gordon Hayward's injury. I had a double compound fracture in my arm in high school playing basketball. And so when I saw that happen, I heard about it. I didn't see it. I wouldn't watch it because I can't watch that. Did you watch it?
I haven't watched the video either.
So anyway, you're a Boston sports fan, right? You're sold out.
Yeah, oh, totally so. I mean, I'm not as crazy about it as Steve is, but yeah, no, definitely.
But will you concede Yastrzemski shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame?
Go back and look. I mean, growing up, it was Yaz, right?
I know, believe me, he doesn't belong there. It was all lucky there was a dead ball era. Anyway, when you went to work for Konecki, what was the job? What did you do for
him? So back then, he was doing his weekend show.
Right.
And I went in, and I was booking guests. And it was something great about that show. And it was, it was 2 hours on Saturday and Sunday, and you had so much breathing room. And we would do sort of the hard news and all that stuff Steve does so well at the big board. But then there was also a lot of room to do some of the quirkier stuff that Steve loves and that I love. So you could have some fun with it, too. And it was just such a great mix. But talk about how things have changed. I mean, think about we used to start thinking about that show on Wednesday. Can you imagine planning a show now for the weekend and start thinking about it on Wednesday?
No, it's impossible. All you can do is book guests. You can book panels, like I now do a Saturday morning show, and we book the panel early if we're doing a panel. But talk about booking guests, Eric, because this is actually where your sweet spot, you're a genius at this, but a lot of people don't understand that the most crucial role in any broadcast is the individual or team that is bringing the guests to the talent.
Hang on, let me write this down.
It's true.
It's great. It's so much fun, and I think you have to be sort of a people person, and it's just so great because there's so many, the detective work and finding people when you do the offbeat stories, and then it's about like building relationships, and you get to meet so many fun people, and obviously I've gotten to get to know you and my buddy Niall Stanage, who was on your first episode of this show that I was emailing with last night about this. It's just so great to get to know these people. And
how do you track someone down? Give a young booker some help here if they're looking to say. Let's come up with a for instance. Howard just wrapped up Solo, the movie. Now I've had Ron Howard on the show before when he's had to promote something, and I know his wife and his brother's a friend, and he comes on and does the Super Bowl. So I know how to get to Ron Howard. But if you have no clue on how to get an ass to Ron Howard, how do you go about it? Tell the young booker what they do.
I mean, with someone like Ron Howard, you're not obviously calling him. You might call him directly. I don't know Mrs. Howard. I haven't been over for dinner. So you got to go through, his representatives. You can call places like the Screen Actors Guild, or there's a variety of places, directories that have agency contact information, or just Google. Nowadays you can find anyone. As long as you're willing to dedicate the time to it, you can usually find someone who knows someone who knows someone. But it's different. If you're trying to find Ron Howard, you go more official channels. If you're trying to find, someone who witnessed some crime or some event or something like that, then it's a whole different kind of thing, and you're digging into social media. So there's not one rule, which is, I think, what makes it fun. It kind of keeps you on your toes. And then, luckily, you sort of, once you have these people on once, you hopefully build relationships with them, and then you get they're loyal and they come back, hopefully. If
how possessive are you, Eric Greenberg, over your virtual Rolodex?
My virtual Rolodex, I will tell you that is heavily guarded in my phone. Luckily, we as a network also have a pretty good Rolodex. But no, of course, I have my personal Rolodex, and it grows over time. I have Hugh Hewitt's cell phone number in there.
Yeah.
So I have it under a passcode. But, that's everything, right? You need to
It is
to
everything. And it's also why I never change my email, even though it's completely compromised and spammy. I have a private email account. But you never change your email because people reach out to you after 20 years. And so we have these old accounts that we have to check. So now people know. It's just about time and intuitiveness and inventiveness to find people. But now take us inside the 11th hour. How do you work with Brian to book the show?
So, it works different ways. There are times that Brian has lots of ideas, and we sort of have an ongoing wish list of people he'd like to have. But a lot of it is obviously reactive to what's happening in the news. Something's happening with North Korea, who's great on that, or Bill Richardson's great on that, you know, so let's reach out to him. So it's, you know, a lot of times it's Brian suggesting ideas, other times it's Pat Berkey, our executive producer, who I told I would mention his name, and Colleen King, who runs the show as well, and they generate ideas, and they'll give me a list and say, we want these people, or sometimes I'll just see something and say, you know, this is who we've used in the past, he's been great, or I've used this person coming back to the Rolodex. You know, I had this person back on way back at CNBC, I remember them, kind of thing. So this,
give them a sense of the production day, because I don't think many people really understand how long the day you're. I mean, you're talking to me. We're taping this at 9:30 in the morning. Your show doesn't go on for 14 hours.
So I got home at like 1:30 in the morning this morning from last night.
I really appreciate your getting up to do this.
Trust me. This is a pleasure. But it just shows sort of how the day cycle goes. It's you know, in the morning, we obviously, as a show, you know, I luckily have a great partner, Laura, who I can sort of flip-flop hours with a little bit, so I'm not there late every night. But we you know, it's 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock sort of things start, you know, the preliminary of what are we doing, what's popping in the news. But, of course, before that, everyone's, you know, on their phones, even if you're not in the office, and you're exchanging emails about what looks like it might be popping. And then from there, everyone sort of goes head down. We have some guests pre-booked, you know, sort of our rotating group of, you know, fantastic journalists who are kind and stay up late with us. And then we add more as the day goes on. And you know, like we were talking about before, how news breaks, now it's like you just on the fly so much. I mean, there have been so many nights where news is breaking 9 p.m., 10 p.m., how many Friday nights have there been now where someone's left the White House? And you know, when there never used to be news on Friday nights, especially in the summer. And so you're constantly adjusting on the fly. But everyone, you know, goes there. The segment producers go their separate way and start working on the segments. We, of course, have a show meeting with Brian, and he kind of listens to everyone's pitches and sort of emphasizes what he thinks is important. And you kind of regroup throughout the night, and it sort of slowly comes together.
And so by what time do you think the show is set at the end of, you know, in terms of the guests at least?
In terms of the guests, look, there are some days, I'd love to give you a definitive answer. There are some days the show is pretty set by 3 or 4 p.m. There's some days the show is set by 10:30 p.m., you know? And there's some days when there's breaking news and you're on the phone trying to reach people to call in if something breaks. So I'd say usually we have a pretty good sense by, say, 6 o'clock or so when we're done with our production meeting.
Long day. It is such, and now let's get to the hardest thing in the world, when you have to bump a guest you booked. How does Eric Greenberg do that? Isn't that tough? Isn't that awful?
It is the least fun thing to do. Luckily, you know, we have a show where Brian really appreciates our guests. And, you know, there are some people that, you know, shows that handle it better than others. And I think ours handles it particularly well. And Steve was the same way, where just very considerate of our guest time. And so we don't do it arbitrarily. We really don't. And when you do, it's because we don't do it arbitrarily, they tend to understand that. And it's for good reason. You know, I you got to do the call. It's not me. It's not you. It's me, kind of thing. And you explain to them the situation. I think if you're honest about it, it helps. And they understand, because we, like I said, we have a loyal group of guests who, you know, it's disappointing sometimes, especially if it's someone that hasn't done a lot of TV and they're looking forward to it. Maybe they've already tweeted about it.
Yeah, that's the worst. It's part of the territory, and that requires a set of diplomatic skills. And that's maybe where I want to end up. This all becomes about relationship eventually. You've got to be a good guy or gal to do this, to do what you do, or people will not come on your show. If you're a jerk, they just won't do it.
It's like 1,000% about a relationship. And it's, look, I'm not naive enough to think that everyone comes on the show because of me. They come on because of Brian. But I think when people are treated a certain way, they notice. You know, and you try to, you try to build relationships with people. And first of all, it's more fun that way, you know, and you get to know these people, get to be friends with them. You know, there's so many interesting people that come through. You know, John Meacham was in the other day, and then sort of just chatting with him about the process of how long it takes him to put a book together and things like that. It's just so interesting to talk with all these people. But along the way, you build these relationships, and they know that you're a straight shooter, and you're not going to jerk them around. And if you cancel, there's a good reason for it.
Yep.
And it, if it's not a firm booking and, you know, we're still kind of figuring the day out, you try to be honest about that. And I think for the most part, you know, especially the reporters who know and really understand how quickly news is changing, they get it, right? Because they're in the business. So
let me finish up this way. You have worked for Jim Cramer, Larry Kudlow, Steve Kornacki, Brian Williams. You've been blessed to work with very smart people. Have you ever had, don't name any names, have you ever had to work for a dummy?
A dummy. I've had, you know what I found? It's not, the people at the top aren't generally the challenge. A lot of the people, it's in certain circumstances, it's, you know, people who are trying to get to the top, who aren't where they need to be, can be challenging. Yeah, have I worked for a dummy? No, you don't get to, sort of that point where you'd be running a show that you're a real dummy. I've worked with people that I've had sort of differences of opinion with, and a lot of that tends to do with more the type of thing you're saying, that are the things that make it hard to build those relationships with guests. And, you know, I it's important to me to treat guests a certain way, and luckily for the most part, I've worked for people that agree with that.
It's my roundabout way of telling young people, especially, they've always got to be reading and thinking and be smart about stuff, because if they're going to rise in this business, you've got to read, think, write, and absorb information constantly. You just can't live in a cave.
And by the way, that doesn't mean you're going to get along with everyone you work with. It's like any other business, you know, and you just have to find a way to come together. And, you know, it won't be the first last person that you have trouble working with, but look, usually you can come together for sort of the greater good of the show. And luckily, especially where I am now, there's a lot of great people. And like any other business, it's sort of, you know, the environment you find yourself in. And it's usually from the top down, as far as just sort of enjoying the ride.
Last question. Where do you want to be in 40 years? I mean, what do your career arc? Do you have an ambition, or are you living it day to day?
Oh, God. What do I want to be when I grow up? That's a great. Right now, I love what I'm doing. Like you said, I'm lucky to work with for a great anchor and host, and still get to see people like Steve around the building all the time, who are great. I don't know. You know, I think I'd like to build on what I'm doing. There's always, like, you know, little projects you wanna work on, but I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll end up out of my lane again.
Are you a TV news guy for good, though, do you think?
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, TV, for right now, for sure. I mean, especially, right, like, how do you leave TV news right now?
That's it. I don't think many people, well, you can get carried out, sadly, but I don't think anybody leaves willingly. It's too much fun. Hey, Eric Greenberg, I've taken too much of your time already. I appreciate your coming on Background and giving young journalists especially a sense of just be open to everything and work all the time.
That's pretty much what it comes down to.
Eric Greenberg, thank you, my friend. Be well, and don't miss the next edition, America, of On Background with Hugh Hewitt.